in the first song, and it was the desire of our heart that your Spirit would come and move among us. And even now, Lord God, through all that is said and through all that is not even said, beyond that, your Spirit would come and sovereignly work among us and speak to us. Amen. Well, most of you know that when it comes to God's provision for us, there is a parable, a miracle in the Bible called the feeding of the 5,000. And the feeding of the 5,000 comes in all four Gospels. All four Gospels have it. But there's another story. There's another story that we're going to look at today. It comes in all four Gospels. Variants slightly differ. It may be two stories. But the gist, the basic gist is the same. And I'd like us to look at that story. But before we look at that story, I can just want to tell you that the variations of the story that we're going to look at this morning is found in Matthew 26, Mark 14, and Luke 7. I won't tell you the verses. If you want to go to it, then you'll find it. Our text this morning is from John chapter 12, verses 1 to 8. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrived at Bethany where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here, a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. Martha served, while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. Then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Leave her alone, Jesus replied. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Now this passage is about possessions, and of course it's about money. I am told, I haven't counted this, but I am told that Jesus talked more about money than any other single thing. But that's Jesus. You see, when men and women talk about money in the church, the hearers may rightly think, more money needed for the church. There is a nepotistic conspiracy between John and Ashley. He doesn't want to talk about it. So the brother-in-law can talk about it. Or, this is Ashley, come from a third world country, doing some Christian work. He's come to a first world country, and maybe some finances needed. And the hearers have their right reasons for thinking that way. Or, when we talk about money, hearers may think, he is going to make me feel guilty about my affluence. Because in New Testament terms, both the church in England and some of the churches in Karachi, Pakistan, are rich. So when Jesus talked about the rich and talked about the poor, well, we fall in the category of the rich, not the poor. So he's going to make me really feel guilty about all that I have. And hearers have good reason to think about that and to feel that way. Or, this sermon is about him telling me to sell all that I have and to enter a life of voluntary poverty. And so that's what he wants me to do. That's what he's aiming towards. He's seen what all I have, and he wants me to get rid of it all, because he thinks this interferes with my discipleship. He wants me to get rid of it, everything that I have. And hearers have good reason to think about this and to believe this. But today, and I'm ever so glad we took the collection before the sermon. Thank you, Brian. Today, I don't want you to do something. Today, I want you to think. To think. I know that sometimes when we think, when we come to church, we may feel that we can deposit our thinking capacity at the door. But today I want you to think. To think about money. And as you see these papers disappearing, you know the sermon is coming to an end. To think about money. To think about your discipleship. But most of all, to think about God. Think about God. So let's look at this story. Let's start beginning it at verse 1. You can see that the context, the surroundings of this story is actually at a very difficult time for Jesus. While we were singing, we were talking about our pain. But it's 6 days before Passover. You know what happened at Passover. So the context is a context of great difficulty for Jesus. He was going to be going to something that was ever so difficult for him. But also, you can see that the house where he arrived at is a house where somebody experienced death and resurrection. And not only did he experience death and resurrection, there were people around him who knew that he had died and now he's alive. They had experienced 4 days of pain. 4 days of pain. And here in this house, it's very interesting, you know, we do say, you know, Jesus, please come and be present, and we should say that, and we should desire it, and we should feel more and more and desire more and more that Jesus comes in our presence when we are together. That should be our desire. But you know what? It's interesting what happens when Jesus comes. Because in this house, there were people who were listening, wanted to hear what he had to say. There were people who had questions in their mind, testing, you know, what is he going to do? What's he up to? There were people who were perhaps just seeing and observing what's going on. There were people who were thinking. There were people like Lazarus who was relaxing. We can just go a little bit higher. You see? At this place. And of course, if your brother has been raised from the dead, you better put on a good dinner. Now, when I first came to England and I came to be with my in-laws, you do things slightly differently here. Because I came to England and I must say I got bolder afterwards, but I came to England and I saw that my to-be mother-in-law prepared all these vegetables and this meat and this gravy and all these things. And about 20 people together. The family is a big family. And, you know, the meat was taken out, the vegetables were taken out, and everything was taken out. And, you know, the pans at the end of the distribution were empty, right? I think this lady Martha, and we know a little bit about her reputation, I don't think it was like that kind of a dinner. I think, oh boy, she went to town to prepare this dinner. That's an important thing to do. Because if she didn't prepare the dinner, the local fish and chip shop would have been, you know, invaded. Right? And there was fish and chips there. Peter and... I imagine this overflowing table or whatever, wherever they put the food, of all kinds of things over there. Now you see Lazarus reclining, typical man in Middle East, reclining at the table with Jesus. She's there, she'll do it. So let's keep in mind that all the people present, you know, we want Jesus to come, all the people present were doing important things, even if it was listening, even if it was just standing and seeing and testing him out, and even if it was cooking. Now, they were doing important things. And then, you can turn the page, and then Mary goes and spoils it all. She really goes and spoils it all. Here's everybody doing important things, and then she comes and does a beautiful thing. You see, I think of my life, and I only want to tell you about me, because, you know, you just hear me once and I'll fly off 5,000 miles away. You haven't a clue what I'm all about. Right? But my life for Jesus can be filled with all the important things that I do for Jesus. It can be filled. It can be a life. It can be a life that's a life of monochromic. You know monochromic? Black and white. It can be a life of a monochromic feature with all the important things, devoid of the color. And therefore, I've got to ask myself, and I've got to ask you, you know, at the end of our life, it is, here lies Ashley, he did all the important things, black and white. And I have to ask myself, am I challenged that within this monochrome, within this vast monochrome of doing important things, preaching and reading and visiting and all these things, is there some color? Is there some color to my life? Is there some color? Mary came and brought beauty, but it also brought color, right? And I know that when I talk to English people, they're all very nice people, you know. Yeah, really, really. But I'm talking about color. I'm talking about color. I know you do the important things. And I know you're faithful in doing the important things. But color, she comes and brings color, brings significance by her very act. But beauty is costly. You all know that, don't you? Beauty is costly. When I go to Karachi, the reason why I have this beard is not because of it's some fashion point. It's laziness. I do not have to shave. And so in Karachi when I go, once every 3 weeks, I sit in front of the barber. This is a different story to tell. I sit in front of the barber, I cut my hair, trim my beard. 3 weeks it'll work. But when I go to the barbers, this new thing that's come out, it's called a facial. We men are involved in facials. And to me, a facial is an oversupply of mayo along with cucumbers. Two pieces of cucumbers and an oversupply of mayo. But you see, we Pakistanis, we want, and we pay a big amount of money. It's costly. Being beautiful involves costs. We Pakistanis want to get like you English people without a tan. And for you, beauty is costly too, because in order to achieve that goal, you have to go to the south of France. Not in these days. And you end up getting burnt, but beautiful. Right? It's costly. It is costly, this thing. And when Mary was doing the beautiful thing, we got to understand the Eastern culture. She was saying, bye-bye marriage. Now, for you, that may not mean anything because you are all independent women. That if you don't get married, well, you know, don't have to share half of my house. You know? But for her, Eastern women, marriage is big. It's the only thing. It's the thing you are trained for. It's the thing you are prepared for. It is the ultimate. You are reared, you are trained, because you're going to be married. And the expensive perfume is your dowry. It's your dowry. And so you sell your perfume, and you buy your costume, and you pay for the food. Because marriage went on several days in the Middle East. Right? So she was saying, bye-bye marriage. She was saying, bye-bye marriage. Now, most of you would know some of your history. And if you don't, I'll give you a history lesson. Your ancestors came to my country, right? And you taught us a few things. We were confused about a few things, but you taught us a few things. Our first confusion was, we got 10 fingers, why can't we use them to eat? Why do we need a fork and knife? We are reversing this morning. Christine is teaching some of the young ladies how to cook a curry, and then you'll have to eat it with some bread, and you'll have to use your fingers. Right? So we're reversing them. So, but we got confused. And then you said, these natives, they need to learn English. You know, otherwise, how are they going to be cultured? And we got confused about English too. You see? Because you came and told us that B-U-F-F-E-T is buffet. We didn't understand that. But you said, no, it's buffet. And then you took out your King James Bible and you read about the storm and the wind and the waves hitting the boat and you said it was buffeted by the wind. We got confused. We got confused because you said this and then you said that. Now, when do you say buffet and when do you say buffet? You know, we were confused. But then, you see, what happened was this. Let me tell you what happened. What happened was this, is that you taught us a little bit about spelling. You told us a story. And you said, sometimes words are not spelt the way you think they're spelt. So we listened. And you told us a story about a storm, a boat, disciples, Jesus walking on the water, and then Peter walking on the water. And you said, that's faith. So I said, oh. And then you said, but actually faith is not spelt the way you think it's spelt. So we got confused again. You said, faith is spelt R-I-S-K. Yeah. Oh, then we thought, that's living theology. Well, I know the mental theology about faith, but that's living theology. And so I discover that, yeah, okay, that's what faith is all about. It's about taking risks. It's about doing it. That's what she did. She took a risk. Future wiped out. And she took the risk. But as soon as beauty enters the room where Jesus is, as soon as faith or risk is demonstrated in very real terms, not in theories that we talk about while we drink coffee and the jargon we use while we drink coffee, as soon as that happens, a chorus is raised up. And that chorus that is raised up is a chorus of sense and sensibility. That's what the chorus that is raised up. Now, I find myself singing that chorus. And as I do enter on singing that chorus, could we go one more? As I do enter myself singing that chorus, I discover that Judas is the lead singer of sense and sensibility. I discover that. But not only that, I don't only discover that. You know what else I discover? I discover that my sense and sensibility, one more, my sense and my sensibility and the song that I am singing and the chorus that I am singing is actually a camouflage for my consumerism. It's because I want to consume. I'm sensible. I'm very sensible. And so it becomes this camouflage. And I find myself in that group, not in the RISK group. That's where I find myself. Very sensible. And people say all kinds of things to me. You see, that other group, you've just been reading about David. I think you're studying about the life of David. Now, which war college would advise you that when the opponent is heavily armed with American weaponry, that you go down to the Beverly Beck to collect stones? Madness. Madness. Who would advise you, when you start hearing voices that you've never heard before, to leave the Ur of the Chaldeans, where they had beautiful houses and running water, to go on a trek where all your life you'll end up living in a tent? Madness. What? I don't understand how Sarah continued to be beautiful when she didn't have proper washing facilities for her hair. I just don't understand. Madness. Madness. But that's RISK. That's RISK. You see? So that's where I find myself. I find myself in that chorus. And therefore I tell you all these things. You're just listening to me preaching myself to myself. Because I was asked to speak on money. I had to prepare on money. So you're just hearing me preach to myself. That's all. And so I want to call you to a living theology. I want to call you to a living theology. Let me just tell you. Last week we sung the chorus, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound." Not the hymn, but "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me." Right? I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. Now I find, and this is, you know, these very weak Christians in Pakistan, okay, so it may not apply to you, right? Now I find that that's great to know that. We must repeat it to ourselves, we must say it to ourselves, we must live it, and we must live it daily. But you know what? You get a chance only once in a lifetime to cross the Red Sea on foot. You're saved. And once you cross the Red Sea, it comes back together. Then you begin a 40-year journey. And in that 40-year journey, you have to get up every morning, go outside, collect manna, and if you collect too much and put it in your refrigerator, maggots get it, except for Friday. And for 40 years, they had to live trusting God's adequacy, that God will show up tomorrow morning. And although I don't have anything to eat, he'll show up and he'll provide. 40 years to learn that lesson. The Red Sea, just something that happened, crossed it. Great. So it's great to remind ourselves of our salvation. But then there's another step beyond that. You see, trusting God's adequacy is important for our day-to-day decisions that we make regarding money, regarding possessions, regarding everything. It's important. And I want us to think about that. You see, God's abundance is an invitation to our generosity. God's abundance. And 2 Corinthians says this to us. And I want you to know, brothers, and now, brothers, we want you to know about the grace that God has given the Macedonian churches. Out of the most severe trial, the overflowing joy and the extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I can testify that they gave as much as they were able, and even beyond their ability, entirely on their own. They urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in this service to the saints. And they did not do as we expected, but they gave themselves first to the Lord and then to us in keeping with God's will. Now, did you notice, if we can go back to the first verse. Did you notice that in that text, beginning of verse 1, the kind of contradictory words over there. You know, if we can go one more up. Really kind of contradictory words in this. Just one more page up. How can you be severely tried and have overflowing joy? How can you have extreme poverty and rich generosity? How on earth does that happen? I mean, you know, I was talking about you having a collection or John asking a collection. You know, I've got to go back to Karachi and say, you know, we need to send, you know, the King's Church in England, you know, some money. How can that happen? That can only happen with the people who have learned to trust in the abundance, in the adequacy of God. But not only that. Last page. Not only that. You see, generosity leads to dedication. Can we go one more page up? Their generosity, and I hope I'm not talking only theory. Please, if I'm only theory, you know, tell me, keep quiet, sit down. Because they gave beyond their ability, entirely on their own. And then we go up one more. So that's their generosity and sharing the servants. And they did not do this as we expected, but they first gave themselves to the Lord. Dedication. Now, you and I can hear a lot about dedication, but it kind of streams from that. But not only dedication, they gave themselves to us. Community. They not only gave themselves to God, vertical, they gave themselves to us, and it outflows from their generosity. That is the order. Now, my friend, and some of you may have heard him, his name is not my friend, I've talked to him once, but you may have heard of him. His name is David Pawson. And he says, one of the last things to get converted is your pocket. And when that does get converted, then we can talk about dedication and community. That's the order. That is the order of the day. But there's also a danger, and I want to talk to you about the danger. The danger of neglecting these things. The danger of neglecting color, of neglecting beauty, of neglecting generosity and dedication and community. There is a danger. Our friend Moses told us something about that. Now, I look after old people. Part of my work in Karachi is not only preach in a church, but to look after old people. We look after old people that have nobody. So we don't have an NHS, so I take them to the doctors, and I take them here, and I take them there. And you know that as you get older, two of the big difficulties are Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. Right? Yes. And I'm told Alzheimer's is kind of when you forget things, right? And kind of you don't even remember your own children. And our dear Moses said, beware of premature Alzheimer's. Beware of premature Alzheimer's. Because it can hit you even before the doctors prescribe it. Let's look what he said in Deuteronomy. I'll translate this. Okay, it's difficult English, but I'll translate it for you. So Moses is saying, when your kitchen cupboards are full, and your freezers are full, and your mortgage is paid, and you have enough money saved up for the retirement home, right? That's what it's saying in modern day Babylonian language. That's what it's saying. Then you're in danger. You're in danger of your heart becoming proud. And then Alzheimer's comes and will forget the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. We go on. One more page. And you may say to yourself, you know, my job in the city did it. But remember, again, Alzheimer's there. The Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the ability to produce wealth, and so confirms his covenant, which he swore to you today. See, Moses is saying you can be in danger of spiritual amnesia. Okay? And Moses is saying the danger of affluence is amnesia. That's the danger. And I'm not saying all of you who are affluent are in a state of amnesia. I'm not saying that. That's Moses is talking about the dangers. And I must warn you about the dangers. That's the dangers. And so, let me conclude. You see, I believe that deep down in our heart, I don't believe any of you are not committed. I don't believe that. I believe you take the fact that you're here when you can be at Bridlington, you know, says volumes about you. Says volumes about you and your commitment to God. And so I believe that you are a people that want color in your lives. You know about the monochrome, the important things, but I believe you're people who want color. I believe you are a people that want to sing among a group that sings the chorus correctly. I believe you are a people who will only revert to sensibility when God shouts out from heaven and says, "Abraham, Abraham, stop it! Don't lay a hand on that fellow. There's a ram that's caught in a thicket." That's what you would deem as sensible. I believe you are a people who want to hear that voice and be sensible. Now, in my pocket, I've got something. Please don't put it in the collection. It's a coin. It's a coin that's been... You can come and see it. I'll keep it here. Don't take it home. It's a coin that has been... The mint. It's been minted in Pakistan. It's a memorial coin. Right? And in memorial coins, we celebrate somebody's life. Right? So it's worth quite a bit of money in Pakistan. The face over here, this is the first time, the face on this coin is of a German nun. She left her home and came to work with the lepers in Pakistan. She left everything. She passed away. She got a state funeral in Pakistan. A hospital was named after her. And I find it significant, coin, money, and somebody's dedication is inscribed on this. She's a woman with color, a woman who lived recklessly. I mean, Germany, you can't compare Germany with Pakistan. I mean, you know. I may be patriotic, but I'm trying to be a bit realistic. She gave her life for lepers. Nobody wanted to touch them. Like the Bible times, they were unclean. And when she died, the government said, "This lady's got a lot of color. And lest we forget her, let's put her face on a coin." Money and dedication, all wrapped up in one. And I believe all of you want to do that. I sincerely believe that. I sincerely believe that. The reason why I say what I say is because there's a loud voice outside that says, forget about the color. Try to be cautious. And don't throw everything to the wind. And you and I are battling that voice day by day. So may you find strength. Just like I have to find that strength in Karachi. And believe me, it's the same thing, okay? We don't have four supermarkets in one area. But it's the same thing. It's the same thing. In fact, sometimes poorer people struggle more with materialism than richer people, okay? So it's the same thing. It's the same thing. And I just hope and pray and that your life will be colorful, that your life will move away from the cautions that are spoken outside there, and that you would abandon yourself to God. God bless you.
Thank you. Well, that's the end of our meeting now. Please do stay for coffee and tea afterwards. If you want to talk to Ashley, that's absolutely fine. I'm sure he'd be happy to talk to you. If anybody wants prayer for anything, please do come and to the front at the end, and someone would be really happy to pray for you. Thank you, and we look forward to seeing you again. next week.